from Turtle Island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. President Biden called Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's policies in Gaza a mistake and urged Israel to call for a temporary ceasefire to allow in more aid. Biden's comments came in an interview that aired Tuesday on the Spanish-language TV network Univision. In his remarks, Biden highlighted the Israeli airstrike last week on an aid convoy that killed 7 aid workers with the food charity World Central Kitchen. 6 of those aid workers international.
I think what he's doing is a mistake. I don't agree with his approach. I think it's outrageous that those three vehicles were hit by drones and taken out on a highway where it wasn't like it was along the shore. It wasn't like there was a convoy moving here, et cetera. So what I'm calling for is for the Israelis to just call for a ceasefire, allow for the next 6-8 weeks total access to all food and medicine going into the country. I've spoken with everyone from the Saudis to the Jordanians to the Egyptians. They're prepared to move in. They're prepared to move this food in. And I think there's no excuse to not provide for the medical and the food needs of those people. They should be done now.
Following the airstrike on the World Central Kitchen convoy last week, Biden called Netanyahu and warned for the first time the U.S. would be forced to change its policy if Israel did not change its policies in Gaza. Israel responded by pledging to open new aid crossings. However, the U.N. said Tuesday there's been, quote, no significant change in the volume of humanitarian supplies entering Gaza, unquote. And the Biden administration has not actually changed its policies or withheld any arms transfers to Israel. This comes as Human Rights Watch is calling on governments to impose targeted sanctions on Israel and suspend arms transfers to press the Israeli government to ensure access to humanitarian aid. The rights group has accused the Israeli government of using starvation as a weapon of war. At least 32 people, including 28 children, have died of malnutrition and dehydration in northern Gaza, where famine is setting in. In the south, at least 5% of children under age 2 were found to be acutely malnourished. Meanwhile, Israeli airstrikes continue across Gaza, including dozens of strikes in Gaza City, as well as in central Gaza, where an airstrike hit a home in the Nusayrat refugee camp today, killing at least 14 people, including 5 children. For more, we're joined by Middle East analyst Muin Rabbani. He's an editor of Jedalia and host of the Connections podcast. He's a contributor to the new book, Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. He was previously a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us here in studio in New York. I wanted to start off with a clip yesterday. British Foreign Minister David Cameron stood with Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a news conference. They were at the State Department. Cameron said Britain's position on arms sales to Israel was unchanged.
The latest assessment leaves our position on export licenses unchanged. This is consistent with the advice that I and other ministers have received. And as ever, we will keep the position under review. Let me be clear, though, we continue to have grave concerns around the humanitarian access issue in Gaza, both for the period that was assessed and subsequently.
And then you have Blinken and Cameron shaking hands. Can you talk about what President Biden is saying, what's happening on the ground in Gaza, and why what the U.S. does matters, not to mention Britain saying they're continuing arms sales?
Well, President Biden referred to Israeli policy towards the Gaza Strip is a mistake. I mean, a mistake is when you take a wrong turn at a traffic light, or perhaps when a surgeon removes the wrong kidney. But when over the course of 6 months, half a year, you kill tens of thousands of people, with perhaps additional tens of thousands buried under the rubble and decomposing, that's not a mistake. That's a deliberate policy, and that's why Israel has been hauled in front of the International Court of Justice on charges of genocide. I think the second issue here is that words are cheap and statements are a dime a dozen, and Israel over the decades has learned that it can safely ignore statements, whether by U.S. or European decision makers, that are essentially playing to the gallery. Because what really matters is not what these people say, but what they do. And when the United States, United Kingdom, the European Union indicate that there is not going to be any consequences, that Israel will continue to be allowed to act with impunity, that there will be no consequences for Israel's actions, then Israel's leaders, whether Netanyahu or any of his predecessors, know that they can safely ignore statements such as the ones we've been hearing.
Moin Rabbani, I wanted to ask you, the UN Security Council is going to make a formal decision on Palestine's bid for full UN membership this month. But the U.S. Will likely veto this if it is approved. And the U.S. is saying that Palestine needs to negotiate statehood with Israel before it is granted statehood by the UN. Your response to this is obviously when Israel was admitted into the UN, the Palestinians were not asked to first negotiate Israel's statehood?
Well, I think the U.S., despite several statements over the years to the contrary, has had a consistent position against Palestinian self-determination, against Palestinian statehood. It has recently voted against several resolutions in the U.N. General Assembly reaffirming the inalienable right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. And essentially, what the U.S. government is saying is that it will not support Palestinian statehood unless Israel does so. And Israel's position is crystal clear on this matter. It rejects Palestinian statehood. So, in other words, the U.S. is subcontracting its position on Palestinian statehood to Israel and adopting it as its own.
I also wanted to ask you about Prime Minister Netanyahu claiming that the date is set for the attack on Rafah, but at the same time, Palestinians are being allowed to return to Khan Yunis after Israel basically destroyed that city. Your response to that?
I think that's a situation that is a little unclear, because both the United States and the Europeans have come out against an Israeli ground operation in Rafah. Netanyahu has claimed a date for that operation has already been set. His defense minister, Yoav Gallant, has said that no such date has been set. Netanyahu has also been saying that if Israel does not enter Rafah, it will not be able to win this war. And this may be a maneuver by Netanyahu to essentially claim that it is because of the United States and it is because of the Europeans and their opposition to an operation in Rafah that Israel's military campaign in the Gaza Strip has failed, and then also to use these differences with the U.S. for domestic political reasons.
Moin Rabbani, can you talk about what's going on in Cairo right now, the negotiations between Hamas and Israel? Can you talk about the prisoners and the hostages? I know that's being debated. I mean, I think in the West Bank, it's something like 8,000 people have been taken prisoner, many of them children, since October 7th. And you have something like 130 hostages, Israeli and other foreign nationals, taken by Hamas and other groups on October 7th. And then the whole issue of a ceasefire and letting aid in.
Yes, there are a number of issues that are being negotiated. One of them is an exchange of captives. Another is, and for that, formulas are being discussed about how many captives, how many Palestinian captives Israel will release in exchange for the Palestinians releasing the Israeli and other captives in the Gaza Strip. A second concerns a ceasefire, whether it will be temporary or permanent, and Hamas and Palestinians are, of course, insisting that a temporary pause in fighting, during which there's an exchange of captives and then this genocidal assault resumes, it doesn't really make sense. A third issue is an Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. And a fourth, and apparently the most important sticking point, is whether or not Palestinians who have been displaced, primarily from the northern Gaza Strip, many of whom are now in the Rafah region, will be allowed to return to whatever is left of their former homes. And in fact, it is on this issue that, according to reports, Israel is proving the most obstinate. It has stated that it would allow women and children, but not military-aged men, to return to the northern Gaza Strip. The Palestinians are insisting that such return be unrestricted. And there is apparently now a proposal where Israel would withdraw from this barrier that it established to bisect the Gaza Strip, and that it would be manned by Egyptian forces to ensure that no armed men would go from the southern to the northern Gaza Strip. Whether this is something that will be accepted by both parties remains to be seen. But it's interesting that of all these issues we've been hearing about, it is actually Israeli opposition to the return of displaced refugees to the northern Gaza Strip that is proving to be the main sticking point.
What's Israel's goal in all of this?
I believe it's to make the Gaza Strip unfit for human habitation. Of course, Israel entered this war hoping and intending to eradicate and eliminate Hamas as a government and as an armed force, and thought it could do so within a matter of weeks, if not a few months. That has proven to be an abject failure. But I think there's a wider objective here, that it had an almost insatiable lust for revenge after October 7th. It wanted to make an example out of the Gaza Strip in order to deter Palestinians or any of its surrounding adversaries from ever considering an attack on Israel like this again. And I think it also has a long-standing issue with the presence of so many Palestinians, particularly Palestinian refugees from 1948, on its border. This is a policy that goes back to the 1950s and has seen in this crisis, and more importantly, in the unconditional Western support that has received since October 7th, to resolve its Gaza problem, if you will, to either displace the Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip or to make it unfit for human habitation.
And Muina, I wanted to ask you, there's a lead story in today's New York Times that's claiming that Iran has been flooding the West Bank with weapons in an effort to basically stoke an uprising of Palestinians on the West Bank. I'm wondering your sense of that, because the report doesn't talk much about all of the repression and attacks and killings of Palestinians that have been occurring in the West Bank, especially since the October 7th attack by Hamas.
Well, there's a reason people refer to the New York Times as American Pravda. I mean, in this particular report, there's virtually no evidence of any significant Iranian arms deliveries to the West Bank. And when you consider how limited Iranian arms deliveries to the Gaza Strip have been, it doesn't really make sense to believe that there are significantly more weapons being delivered to a territory that is under much more intensive Israeli control. And again, you know, there's been this decades-long attempt to seek to show the Palestinians as somehow not having any legitimate grievances of their own, as always acting on behalf of someone else's agenda rather than on behalf of their own rights and interests. You know, it used to be they used to be Soviet proxies, then they became jihadists, now they're Iranian proxies. Who knows what they'll be tomorrow? But even if Iran didn't exist, this conflict and this Palestinian struggle for freedom and liberation would be essentially essentially be undiminished. And, you know, this particular article makes a lot of claims, but provides virtually no evidence to substantiate those claims.
Talk about what Israel did in Damascus, bombing the Iranian consulate. Now they've reopened one there.
Yes.
And what exactly is going on? We're hearing all kinds of reports that Iran and the U.S. have made a deal that if the U.S. gets a ceasefire in Gaza, that Iran won't attack U.S., which is arming Israel. We hear GPS is turned off in Israel so that Iran can't attack Israel. Yes.
Well, in contrast to many previous Israeli attacks on Iranian targets in Syria, this one targeted the Iranian consulate in Damascus, which is sovereign Iranian territory. And the Iranians have indicated that, from their point of view, the response would need to be direct rather than through, for example, allied militias, and that from their point of view, they would launch an attack directly from Iranian territory onto Israeli territory. Apparently, according to news reports, the Iranians have made an offer to the Americans, which is that if the Americans impose a permanent ceasefire and put an end to this genocidal Israeli assault at the Gaza Strip, that will be considered a closure of the file. Also, because I think the Iranians and many others, for that matter, believe that it's an Israeli ambition to further escalate this war regionally and seek to draw the Americans into a direct confrontation with Iran. It's a little unclear. I mean, we've seen indications from the Americans that this is something they're considering, but thus far, at least, we haven't seen confirmation that they are actually going to act on this proposal and impose a ceasefire.
Yeah, I wanted to get back for a moment to the negotiations over a ceasefire. We keep hearing in the U.S. press that the holdup is Hamas not agreeing to the conditions of a deal that's already on the table. I'm wondering your thoughts about this, because it seems to me that it's much more in the interest of Israel to continue not having a ceasefire while it continues to conduct its operations rather than Hamas.
That's correct, and I think we also need to recognize that when we hear the term American proposal, what we're really talking about is an American proposal that has been closely coordinated and approved by Israel. So it's essentially an American communicated Israeli proposal. And there, as we were discussing previously, there are fundamental elements of this proposal that are unacceptable not only to Hamas, but to Palestinians generally. The idea that you would have a 6 to 8 week pause and fighting, and then this genocidal assault would resume in full force, is, I think, completely nonsensical. The idea of Palestinian men not being allowed to return to their former homes in the Gaza Strip, that Israel would still continue to have control over the delivery of aid to the Gaza Strip. And so these are all issues that are under discussion. But as we've seen in the aftermath of the Israeli killings of the World Central Kitchen staff, it literally takes only a phone call from the White House to resolve these issues. And so I think it's fair to assume that if the United States really wanted a ceasefire, it would only take another phone call. And the absence of that phone call, I think, is also a policy statement from Washington.
I wanted to go to that Lloyd Austin hearing in the Senate,
yes,
where the conservative Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton was questioning the U.S. Defense Secretary. This is protesters were being taken out of the room, calling for ceasefire. I think something like 50 people were arrested in the Senate cafeteria calling for ceasefire. This is Cotton questioning Austin.
I want to address what the protesters raised earlier. Is Israel committing genocide in Gaza?
Senator Cotton, we don't have any evidence of genocide being created
So that's a no. Israel is not committing genocide in Gaza.
We don't have evidence of that, to
Thank
my
you.
Knowledge. Yeah.
We don't have evidence of Israel committing genocide in Gaza. Your final response as we begin to wrap up.
Well, Cotton had a similar incident with CIA Director William Burns a few weeks ago, and he failed to get a clear response from Burns. Here, of course, you have Secretary of Defense essentially not wanting to implicate himself in his department. So it was kind of an obvious answer for Lloyd Austin to give.
Muin Rabbani, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Middle
thank
East
you.
Analyst, co-editor of Jedalia, host of the Connections podcast, contributor to the new book, Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. Muin Rabbani was previously senior analyst for the International Crisis Group.
Why does Israel need 2,000-pound bombs to be used in high-density populated areas?
Well, this was incredible to see. Two MSNBC contributors, who are also both former Bush administration officials, expressed their concern over how far right-wing Joe Biden is with his support of Israel. This really gives you the context in how out of whack Biden is with the mainstream. He is far to the right of where Washington typically is, which is already right-wing. Biden, you could argue, is no different on this issue than Donald Trump is. So I'm going to get to these clips. First, if you need any more context with what happened earlier this week with Israel's targeted strikes on seven World Central Kitchen workers, aid workers who are delivering food in Gaza, you can go watch my video on Tuesday about that. I'll link to it below the video. It's this video here. You can search the title as well. I give you more context to what happened there. But this has since come out from the Washington Post here. U.S. approved more bombs to Israel on day of World Central Kitchen strikes. It's, you know, this is a situation where there's a lot more focus on Israel this week because of the World Central Kitchen strikes, because it targeted foreign aid workers, including an American. Now, Israel has been launching these sorts of strikes on civilians for months. I mean, there is no... It's gotten to the point where there isn't even an accurate count right now on civilian casualties, because there is no one there to properly, to accurately count the number of casualties, because it's gotten so out of whack. So, you know, the last recorded number is somewhere around 30,000. It's definitely well above that estimate. Some estimates are putting it around 100,000 at this point. And we're not even talking about, you know, injuries and people displaced from their homes. It is just, it has been an ongoing bombardment. And here you have the U.S. approving more bombs on the day of that strike. Now, don't worry. Joe Biden's on the case. He is prepared to express frustrations with Netanyahu in a phone call on Thursday. These sorts of stories are purposely leaked by the White House, the Biden White House, the Biden campaign, to try and pretend that Biden is concerned about these ongoing attacks on civilians in Gaza. When ultimately, Biden has the power, as you're going to see from two former Bush administration officials, Biden has the power to do a hell of a lot more, including, at the very least, stop sending bombs to Israel. So the first clip here is going to be Elise Jordan. Elise Jordan, again, is currently an MSNBC contributor, a journalist, but is a former Condoleezza Rice advisor in the George W. Bush administration, was also the communications director for the National Security Council. So again, this is somebody who is traditionally right-wing, someone who is to the right of the mainstream. She isn't a Trump Republican, but she was a Republican in the Bush administration. Here are her thoughts on just how far right-wing Joe Biden is.
You know, the president, and this has been bubbling up from behind the scenes for a while. President Biden, frankly, is furious at Prime Minister Netanyahu. But yet still his administration has not conditioned sales, weapons sales, conditioned aid. They haven't done it yet. Now, maybe this is the moment that comes. This also happens just, we think, a week or two, perhaps, before this Rafah offensive, which really could be a flashpoint.
Okay, I'm so sick of hearing how upset President Biden is. The buck stops with him. If he wants to stop arms sales, if he wants to stop the bombs that are indiscriminately killing civilians, he can. He has the power. We don't need him going and his aides going to reporters and talking all background about how upset they are. what happened yesterday is still going to happen. When at Mika's conference, the head of the Palestinian Red Crescent spoke, and she was incredibly moving. This was in Abu Dhabi. And she spoke about the difficulty of aid getting in the country, period, from the north or south. And she described a process that was kind of like the TSA changing the rules every single day, going through airport security. Until those checkpoints are working and aid is going through, we don't need to be giving any more arms sales or money. It needs to stop. It needs to be conditional. It's ridiculous that it's going on unchecked and unfettered, and we're sitting around and talking how upset we are while we hemorrhage billions of dollars.
All right. I just want to first point out that that was an interesting choice of B-roll that had nothing to do with the conversation at all. They were discussing a strike on World Central Kitchen workers, foreign aid workers delivering food in Gaza. And that was the B-roll they chose to play over that conversation? Weird. Now, we are so used to seeing Republicans lobby ridiculous criticisms at Joe Biden. Oh, he's so far left. He's a socialist. He's a communist. He's spending so much money. When you look at like domestic spending in the U.S. compared to, you know, many of its allies, Canada, Europe, it's nowhere near. So to see an accurate criticism of Joe Biden from a Republican, at least a former Republican, I'm not sure where Elise Jordan currently stands. I'm sure she doesn't support Trump, but this is a George Bush Republican. To see this accurate criticism where she's discussing how Biden is even well to the right of where she is refreshing to see. And it adds, I think, important context to understanding just how out of whack Biden's position currently is. Now, I'm going to get to Richard Haass's. He's the other Republican I'll get to in a minute here. His comments on this as well, because they're also very important, add some real context for when he was in a Bush administration. But I want to point out some important things here. So Nathan J. Robinson of Current Affairs shared this data point. Israel has killed more aid workers in the tiny Gaza Strip than have died in all of the countries in the rest of the world combined in any of the last 30 years. This gives you more context to how insane what Israel is doing is. And you can look, you know, this is, again, one data point. You can look at data points about journalists, data points about civilians. The same result in every single one, where what Israel is doing in Gaza is so completely to the extreme. It's the destruction they're causing is so beyond anything we have seen over the past decades that to just, you know, to just call him and say that you're frustrated, like as if this should be the reaction, clearly it's nowhere near enough. Now, this story came out, and this is wild, depressing, terrifying. So from 972 Magazine here, Lavender, the AI machine directing Israel's bombing spree in Gaza. So this goes into, as Ryan Grimm summarizes here, Israel's argument that they kill so many civilians because Hamas uses human shields is torn apart by the revelation that the IDF prefers to attack its targets when they are not at home with their families. It is not Hamas using human shields. It is Israel deliberately hunting families. The information in here is wild, so I'm just going to highlight a bit of it. This investigation by 972 Magazine and Local Call reveals that the Israeli army has developed an artificial intelligence-based program known as Lavender. According to six Israeli intelligence officers who have all served in the army during the current war in the Gaza Strip and had firsthand involvement with the use of AI to generate targets for assassination, Lavender has played a central role in the unprecedented bombing of Palestinians. The Israeli army systematically attacked the targeted individuals while they were in their homes, usually at night, while their whole families were present. So keep this in mind when Israel claims, oh, they're using human shields. Israel is deliberately attacking targets while they are with their families, rather than during the course of military activity. According to the sources, this was because, from what they regarded as an intelligence standpoint, it was easier to locate the individuals in their private houses. Additional automated systems, including one called Where's Daddy, also revealed here for the first time, were used specifically to track the targeted individuals and carry out bombings when they had entered their families' residences. It's even called Where's Daddy? This is how psychotic this government is. An intelligence officer told this report, the IDF bombed them in homes without hesitation as a first option. It's much easier to bomb a family's home. The system is built to look for them in these situations. And this goes to the next story I'm going to touch on here. When it came to targeting alleged junior militants marked by Lavender, the Army preferred to only use unguided missiles, also known as dumb bombs, which can destroy entire buildings on top of their occupants and cause significant casualties. Quote, you don't want to waste expensive bombs on unimportant people. It's very expensive for the country, and there's a shortage of those bombs. And that leads to situations like this. This report just came out of Human Rights Watch. Israeli strike killing 106 civilians, an apparent war crime. So Israel forces unlawfully attacked a residential building in Gaza on October 31st, absent any apparent military target, killing at least 106 civilians, including 54 children. Human Rights Watch analyzed satellite imagery, 35 photographs, and 45 videos of the attack's aftermath, as well as other relevant photographs and videos on social media. Human Rights Watch was unable to visit the site because Israeli authorities have blocked virtually all entry into Gaza at its crossings since October 7th. Israel has repeatedly denied Human Rights Watch requests to enter Gaza over the last 16 years. Think of how much more, whether it's Human Rights Watch, whether it's other human rights organizations, how much more would be revealed if they were actually allowed in. This is why Israel blocks them from even entering. Now, here is Richard Haass. He was an assistant to President H.W. Bush and was also a close advisor to Secretary of State Colin Powell in the George W. Bush administration. Again, a Bush Republican. Here are his thoughts on where Biden stands.
Begin with, and two things have happened in the last few days. One is these attacks are continuing, and yet so are U.S. arms transfers to Israel without conditions. They've been going on for 6 months. Why does Israel need 2,000-pound bombs to be used in high-density populated areas? Then, 10 days ago, what does Israel do? It expropriates 2,000 acres of land in the West Bank for settlement construction. Where is the White House reaction to that? That is how you undo even the possibility, Joe was talking about it, of one day getting to a two-state solution. If you're going to have a Palestinian state, the last I checked, states are built on territory. If the territory isn't there to build it on, you can talk about two states till the cows come home. You don't have it. Where's the administration reaction to that?
You were in the HW administration at the State Department.
At the White House.
At the White House. What would James Baker have done? And seriously, that's what we should be asking ourselves, because that was a moment when we were a diplomatic superpower.
Well, so we confronted Israel. When, if you remember at the time, Israel was subsidizing people leaving the Soviet Union, and they were going into the occupied territories. We basically said it to Israel, we'll help these people to get out of the Soviet Union, but we're not going to subsidize their going into the West Bank. That forecloses options down the road. We understand you may not have a Palestinian partner today, but we want to preserve the option for the day when we might be. And the administration basically said to the Israelis, you have a choice. They made their choices at economic consequences. This administration has got to have some teeth in it.
To see a Republican, or at least a George Bush Republican at the time, to see him concerned about settlement expansion was really amazing to me. And to hear that, you know, the H.W. Bush administration pushed back against Israel when they were trying settlement expansion in the West Bank. This is, of course, completely off the table when it comes to Joe Biden. Not even a consideration. This would be considered a far-left policy under Joe Biden. Yet, here he is. Forget settlements. Sitting back, allowing Gaza to be completely destroyed, bombarded. And the most people get is a phone call to Netanyahu.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Israeli warplanes bombed areas across northern Gaza today, while ground troops conducted raids as the assault on the territory entered its 7 months. Forensic experts from Gaza's health ministry are still removing bodies from the yard of Shifa Hospital, once the largest medical facility in Gaza, that was burned down and destroyed by Israeli forces. Health officials say the number of dead following Israel's raid on Shifa is still not known, but is in the hundreds. Meanwhile, in the south, Palestinians who tried to return to Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, following the withdrawal of Israeli troops Sunday, say it is now unlivable. An estimated 55% of the buildings in the Khan Yunis area, around 45,000 buildings, have been destroyed or damaged, according to two mapping experts at City University of New York and Oregon State University, who've been using satellite imagery to track destruction. This comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has escalated his pledge to invade Rafah, where more than 1.4 million Palestinians, well over half of Gaza's population, are sheltering. In a video statement Monday, Netanyahu said, quote, "It'll happen. There's a date," he said, without elaborating. He spoke as Israeli negotiators were in Cairo discussing international efforts to broker a ceasefire deal with Hamas. The official death toll has now topped 33,300, including over 14,000 children. That number does not include thousands missing under the rubble and presumed dead. Nearly 76,000 people have been wounded. Israel's been accused of using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza, where the spread of hunger and malnutrition has been described as unprecedented, with famine setting in. For more, we're joined by Arwa Damon. She just returned yesterday from a humanitarian trip to Gaza. She's an award-winning journalist and the founder of INARA, the International Network for Aid, Relief and Assistance, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Arwa Damon is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. She previously spent 18 years at CNN, including as a senior international correspondent. Arwa Damon joins us now from Istanbul, Turkey. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Arwa. Can you start off by talking about what you saw in Gaza and what you think needs to be done?
You know, on the one hand, that would seem like a simple question, and yet on the other hand, it's so extraordinarily difficult to actually put what I witnessed into words. In fact, Gazans themselves can't actually grasp the fact that this has become their reality. In Rafah, in this central southern area of Gaza, where you have a crush of about 1.5 million people, it feels as if you're moving through a sea of misery. There is no empty space left. Tents are spilling out of both UN shelters and other makeshift shelters that have emerged. They're spilling out onto the sidewalks. There's stalls that have been set up. The movement of people clogs the streets. You have people having to move around on donkey carts because there's not enough fuel or diesel to power vehicles. And then you just have the sheer need of this entire mass of humanity that is, to a certain degree, feels as if it's absolutely suffocating, because they need everything. They are reliant on others for just about everything, from food to water to medicine to baby formula to diapers. We stepped out in this one area called Mawasi, which is sort of a beachy area. It was Gaza's beachfront. And there, it's just tent after tent after tent in the sand. There's no sewage systems, and so sewage is sort of running along these makeshift canals. There's no proper toilets. There's no nothing. And all of the mothers there are just shoving these emaciated babies at you, you know, begging for proper formula, begging for proper care. They're begging for medicine for children who are epileptic. You walk into a tent, and with each step your foot takes, a cloud of mosquitoes and flies just swarms up. I mean, it's inexplicable.
And Arwa, Israel has in recent days said that it's opening up new entry points into Gaza for aid. Could you talk about the aid that you saw coming in, which still has not reached the level, the number of trucks per day, before the war even started?
Right. And there's a number of things that I think, you know, everyone would be best served to understand about, you know, aid and distribution. So, yes, if more aid is able to get in, absolutely that is going to help. However, when it comes to getting aid to those who need it, it is beyond just opening up additional crossings. The aid trucks that come into Gaza all get searched by Israel, and that is a process that can take around 2 to 3 weeks to begin with. You do see aid being distributed. The problem is that the quantity of the aid is insufficient. Additionally, it's important to note that once the aid gets inside Gaza, getting it distributed within this, you know, tiny little space, yet at the same time extraordinarily difficult to navigate area, poses great and additional challenges. There's a process that's called deconfliction. This exists in all war zones, whereby which aid organizations wanting to reach a certain area will notify warring parties about their intent and will secure permissions to be able to safely move to that area. This is a process that has not and does not work inside Gaza. And the tragic, horrific strike that we saw on the World Central Kitchen convoy is clear evidence of that. And that really sent huge shockwaves within the humanitarian community, because the World Central Kitchen has some of the best deconfliction mechanisms, has some of the best lines of communication to the Israeli side. And so you have these additional layers upon layers of challenges. Add to all of it, the lack of aid has created a very understandable level of panic among the population. What that means is that whenever aid arrives to a certain area, there is chaos and there is panic. And this is why you keep hearing people speaking about the need to flood the zone. The zone needs to be flooded not only with aid so that people can stop panicking and have a certain measure of confidence that they will be getting a stable supply of food, water, and other basic necessities, but also the zone needs to be flooded with humanitarian workers, people who know how to address this level of a humanitarian crisis.
And could you talk as well about the impact of this war, the mental health impact, especially on the children of Gaza that you have spoken so eloquently about in recent days?
I'll give you one example. A mother came up to me and she was she'd heard about the fact that, you know, we do work with mental health, specifically with children. It's also important to note that, you know, when an area population is still in crisis, is still in an emergency, all you can really provide is basic mental health, especially for children. What does that actually look like? It really just looks like a distraction. So creating activities and ways for them to express themselves that can sort of help them distract themselves from all of the horror and the nightmare that they're going through. But this mother comes up to me and she says, I don't know what to do with my 7-year-old right now, because every single night he screams at the top of his lungs and he goes into what look like convulsion and seizures. And he started doing this after he saw his sister's head blown off during a strike that hit their home that also wounded other siblings. You know, you walk around Gaza, and I'm talking specifically about the children right now, but you see this also very deeply in the adults. And you know that sparkle that's normally supposed to exist in a child's eye, it's not there anymore. That's not to say it can't come back and it can't be brought back with these activities. You know, there are these beautiful, heartwarming moments where you are able to create a scenario for a child to be able to, you know, laugh and smile, albeit briefly. But you really feel as if you are walking through a population that is, they're ghosts, and they describe themselves as ghosts. They're ghosts of their past. They're the ghosts of who they used to be, and they're constantly haunted by the ghosts of everything that they have lost. And the trauma doesn't end. It comes at them from multiple different directions every single day. The mental health impact of this is unlike anything that I personally have ever seen 20 years working in war zones. Just the immediacy of the need, the speed with which this all happened. And even people in Gaza, when you talk to them right now, you know, despite having lived through this for 6-7 months, they still tell you that they feel as if, you know, this can't be real, right? Like this can't have happened. This has to be a nightmare from which one day they're going to wake up.
Arwa, you have said, you've pointed out that what's happening in Gaza right now is absolutely egregious, that the Western world, the ones providing the weapons, cannot pressure Israel into allowing more aid and medical staff. Can you talk more about that? I mean, this isn't a natural disaster where, you know, an earthquake happened and people can't get to the people. Explain exactly Israel's role in preventing this aid from getting to those in need.
So nothing goes in and out of Gaza without Israel's approval. Nothing. That includes aid and that includes people. There's a whole process for that. And this is a process that actually existed before October 7th. It is, since October 7th, extraordinarily and excruciatingly long. In addition to that, since 2008, there has been a list of items that are banned entry to Gaza. This list also exists to the West Bank. Now, since October 7th, there have been additional items that are not part of this list that have been rejected. There is no formality to this rejection. We in the humanitarian space end up finding out about items being repeatedly rejected, and as such, there's no point of trying to send them in because of repeat rejections. These items range from things like, you know, solar panels to wheelchairs to certain kinds of medicine to sleeping bags in some cases. Anything that the Israelis say can be deemed to be dual use. But the problem is that it feels very illogical. And again, there's no formality to it. So you don't know if an item is going to get rejected until you actually try to send it in. Some organizations have even had children's toys be rejected. You know, you try to put together these hygiene kits for families, and the nail clippers in them get rejected, and as such, the entire truck gets completely turned around. And so it's extraordinarily difficult to try to navigate that kind of a situation. And obviously, this creates an even greater and more desperate need inside Gaza itself. Now, what is very difficult to comprehend, as you were saying there, is the fact that Israel is an ally to the United States and other very powerful Western nations. Is this the first time that we've seen an area under siege? Absolutely not. Look, I covered Syria very extensively. The regime of Bashar al-Assad, a dictatorship, along with their Russian allies, did, yes, put entire neighborhoods and areas in Syria under siege. But there we were talking about a dictatorship with Russia as its ally. We saw ISIS besiege entire areas in both Syria and Iraq, but we're talking about ISIS. We're not talking about a democratically elected nation state that is an ally of the United States. And that is what makes it so difficult for anyone inside Gaza to comprehend how it is that the United States is allowing Israel to continue to besiege the Strip in such a way. And remember, it was on day one that Israel cut off electricity, water, and basically vowed to cut off, you know, any form of assistance. They cannot comprehend this. They cannot comprehend how it is that this is being allowed to happen to them. On top of that, happening to them, and the United States is still continuing to fund the war effort.
Arwa Damon, I want to ask you about the journalists killed, estimates between 90 and 130, 140 journalists killed by Israel in Gaza alone. You are an award-winning journalist for CNN for 18 years, covered the U.S. attack on Iraq. I wish we saw your reporting more. You mainly did it for CNN International, which would show the picture of the statue of Saddam Hussein coming down in a split screen with the casualties of war, where CNN Domestic would just show the statue of Saddam Hussein coming down hundreds of times. But your reporting was extremely important. I want to talk about seeing the images of casualties on the ground in Gaza. Right now, Israel doesn't allow international journalists in, and domestic journalists in Gaza, so many of them have been killed. Can you talk about the significance of this? Because that leads to people around the world caring to put more pressure.
You know, this is the first time, I would argue, that Gazans have control over the way that their story is being told. And that has made, to a certain degree, the understanding that the Western world has about what's actually happening in Gaza and the toll of all of it shift slightly, because the Western media does not control Gaza's story anymore. Gazans do. I have to say, I mean, I have so much respect and admiration for all of Gaza's journalists, because, you know, when we go into a war zone, wherever it is, as journalists, there comes a point when we get to rotate out, right? You can tap out, you can say, like, I need a break, you know, send in the next crew. They have not been able to tap out for 6 months, and they're not reporting on something that is happening, you know, to a different population. They're reporting on their own people, what's happening to their own families and to their own loved ones. This ongoing effort, however, it would most certainly seem, to try to silence Gaza's journalists is extraordinarily disturbing, but it is sadly part of this whole overarching desire to control the narrative. And right now, though, it's not working, because Gaza's journalists and Gazans, they're not going to stop. And they deserve to be commended for that and for the awareness that they're actually raising about what is happening to them. And it's very, very disturbing, but to a certain degree makes sense from a PR perspective, that Israel is not allowing Western journalists in, because if the scenes that Gazans are witnessing every single day were part of, you know, the regular broadcasts that are happening, there would be a much bigger and stronger outcry than what than anything that we're seeing right now. I mean, you know, I went into the European hospital, which is basically southern Gaza's currently largest and only really remaining, you know, significantly functioning hospital. You walk into, you know, the hospital courtyard, the outdoor pathways, and it's streams of tents, and there's sewage lines running next to the tents. And this is inside a hospital. And people have crammed themselves into the hospital corridors themselves. You have bed after bed of injured, and the injured children with amputations, with horrific burns. I walked into the ICU, and there was, you know, a 10-year-old boy, and the ICU nurse said he's a gunshot victim. He took a gunshot bullet straight to the head. It's just...
Arwa, I wanted to ask you, we only have about a minute for this segment, but I wanted to ask you, we've mentioned that you were a CNN reporter for 18 years, covered many conflict zones. How do you look at the coverage of CNN since October 7th and the degree to which not only CNN, but most Western media outlets are always deferring to Israel to make sure that Israel gets a chance to comment on every single story that they write or that they produce?
You know, October 7th happened and then the coverage began. And I immediately was catapulted back to the post 9/11 era. And I was in New York when 9/11 happened. And I just, my hair stood on end, because it was the same level of, you know, dehumanization that we saw back then. It was the same sort of, you know, panicked, kind of one-sided to a certain degree, reporting that we saw back then. And it was extremely upsetting, because one would hope that, you know, we, the journalism world, the Western journalism space, would have learned the lessons of post 9/11, and that we wouldn't sort of default into this whole dehumanization of the other, And I think it's really important that all journalists are cognizant and should know, you know, we go all over the world. You know, there's a basic fact that we should all know. And that is that, you know, people, we're the same. We love the same. We laugh the same. We live the same. We feel pain in the same way. And yet there was this default back into this dehumanizing rhetoric, this sort of us against them issue. And it was absolutely devastating and gutting and heartbreaking to witness and see that, you know, we defaulted back into sort of that same rhetoric and that same, you know, dehumanization of a population that perhaps, you know, for very superficial reasons, we don't perceive as being like us. And this desire to sort of inflict collective punishment on an entire people.
Arwa Damon, I want to thank you for being with us. Just returned from a humanitarian trip to Gaza, award-winning journalist with CNN, but now founder of Inara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children. Also non-resident senior fellow at Atlantic Council. Spent 18 years at CNN as a senior international correspondent.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity radio show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine. Thank you.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We have been running a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters for the last couple years, and the phone number has recently changed. You can now reach us at 438-858-6116. We would like to thank Fed Phone Line for providing us with this number for free. They wanted us to tell you that they help save money to inmates, family, and friends by reducing the cost of collect calls. For more information about their company, you can go to fedphoneline.com. So again, our new number is 438-858-6116. You can call us collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison at that number. As always, we're an all-volunteer collective and don't always manage to answer the phone. If you can leave a message, please do. If you are calling collect and we don't pick up, try again next time you can get to the phone. And again, our phone number is 438-858-6116, and you can call us collect from Riviere de Prairie Prison or Bordeaux Prison.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Sleepy King starts now.